Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, sweetheart. This is Jeffrey Swartz. I'm a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus, not our Lansing, Michigan campus. I never taught there, but that's where I went to school. And I'm here with my compatriot, Brendan Beery, who is a professor of law at Thomas M. Cooley, WMU Cooley Law School, Tampa Bay campus. He also taught at our Lansing campus, and he went to school at our Lansing campus. And so you've got a pretty good idea how we're going to start this show. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm hanging in there, literally. We are also here with our compatriot and our friend and our patron, Hezzy Harris, who gives us this airtime. Good morning, Hezzy. How are you doing today?
Good morning. A pleasure to have you both on. I look forward to Tuesday every week.
Hi, Hezzy.
It's always a pleasure to be had. Okay, I'll put it that way. It's hard to be funny this morning, and I'm not even going to try. And we're not going to do our usual "What do I really think?" segment because there is only one thing on the minds of at least I think most Americans, and at least I know Brendan and I only have really one thing on our minds, and that is having gone to school in Lansing, which is not East Lansing, I will tell you that, but the difference between Lansing and East Lansing is you cross a street. But East Lansing is the home of Michigan State University. Lansing is, what, 5 miles down one road?
Mm-hmm.
East Lansing, if I'm not incorrect. And it's all part of the city of Lansing, so you feel like you're in the same place. But we're going to talk about some things related to this morning, and it is the only subject that both of us agree has to be, well, we agree on just about every subject, but this is the one thing we agreed needs to be the first thing we talk about today. The first thing is that I think I speak, and not normally do I even try, I think I speak for the faculty of WMU Cooley Law School, its administration. Oh, I forgot the disclaimer. The opinions that Brendan and I espouse and will espouse and do espouse are our opinions alone and are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School and its faculty, either individually or at large. But I'm going to say something now that I think that I speak for, and I feel I can speak, for everyone at WMU Cooley, a school that has existed in Lansing for 48 years now. I was in the first graduating class, so I know how far back it goes, for 48 years now. And we have ties, not official ties, but our students have ties to MSU. Many of them live in East Lansing because that's where students live. And so there is that emotional tie, and there is a physical tie to our school. And I think I speak for everyone when we say that we are shocked, we are appalled, we are beyond sad. There's no way to reconcile what has occurred with anything that we deem to be normal. That what happened to Michigan State last night was just nothing short of devastating. Now, we say that every time there's one of these shootings. And we all say we got to do something. And nothing gets done. Zero. We don't know yet why, and we won't use his name, the shooter, a 43-year-old man who had absolutely nothing to do with Michigan State University. That they have stated. He wasn't an applicant to go to school there. He was never a student there. He did not work there. He had nothing to do with Michigan State University. This shooter who went on that campus hunting Michigan State students. young people, some of whom, by the way, are wearing Oxford shirts from a shooting that took place in Michigan 18 months ago, another school shooting. It just boggles the mind that there are parents out there who sent their kids off to college, a joyous time, and anyone who's gone to college will tell you a joyous time in their life that can never be relived, although they try. And now some of those parents are getting phone calls telling them that their child is dead, or their child is in a hospital in critical condition with life-threatening injuries. And my dollars say, I don't think one or two might survive. I don't think they're going to survive. I think these are headshots. But we don't know that. But the fact of the matter is that it just boggles the mind that we don't do anything. There were good guys with guns all over that campus. Did that stop this guy? Don't want to hear. The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. There's only one way to stop a bad guy with a gun, and that's take everybody's guns away. And I've never really said that before. But it's the only thing to do. I have no other solution but to ban the private possession of guns, which this Supreme Court will find to be unconstitutional. But at least for a few years until they find it unconstitutional, I think that we should start grabbing guns anywhere we can find them. But we'll talk more about that. Our condolences, and again, I speak on behalf of the school on this one, our condolences, our horror at what has occurred goes out to those families, goes out to those victims, goes out to the entire MSU family, and everyone who goes to school there, because they will feel it for the rest of their lives. Their damage will be there. Like the one kid who said, who saw it all happening and said, I will never forget the screams of my fellow students as they were being shot. This is just horrendous. It's not the first college shooting I know. There was Virginia Tech. There was the Dallas shooting. I understand shootings at the University of Texas in Austin. But this is just, I don't know. Brendan, start talking.
Yeah. I had the TV on last night. I wasn't paying attention to it because I was doing something else. But I had it on, and I just glanced over at it and saw, you know, breaking news, active shooter at Michigan State University. You know, this was as it was happening, apparently. And boy, does that hit close to home, quite literally my home for many years. And, you know, and I certainly associate myself with everything you've just said. I got a few more things to say about it. Number one is there is nobody, no community that is not, if it hasn't already been devastated by gun violence, that won't be. If you think it's not coming for you, you're living in la-la land. Gun violence is coming to all of us everywhere. And as you say, there appears to be nothing. There appears to be the political will to do nothing about it. If you're in the United States and you don't want to be shot, there is only one reasonable thing for you to do, and that is stay in your house and never leave. And the minute you leave your house in the United States of America, you are a target. There is all bets are off. We have mass shootings in grocery stores. So if you go to a grocery store, you could be shot. We have mass shootings in movie theaters. If you go to a movie, you're a target. You could be shot. We have mass shootings in all of our schools. If you're a child in a school, you could be shot. We have mass shootings in hospitals. If you call an ambulance and go to the hospital, you've left your house, so now you could be shot. If you go to college, junior college, four-year college, graduate school, you could be shot. If you go to a concert, you could be shot. We live in a country where the only way not to take that risk of being shot is to stay in your house. And the fact that you have to think about those things, I think about the possibility of gun violence every time I go to the supermarket. You walk in that building and you have no idea who is in there and what weapons they're carrying. You have no idea what their agenda is. And I don't know about anybody else, but I literally, every time I go to a place where I'm in public, I'm looking around thinking who's going to be next. Now, I own a gun. It's not a massive assault weapon. It's a semi-automatic pistol. Small caliber, nothing serious. Not a Glock or anything. And to Jeff's point, when he says we need to take everybody's guns, I would give that thing away in a heartbeat. I don't care. Come get it. You're not going to have to pry it out of my cold, dead hand. You can have it. But here's the thing about that. The reason I would turn it over without even thinking twice is that that weapon is not where I get my sense of power and purpose in the world. I don't have such a hopeless life, such a sad station in life, that holding that weapon is the way I feel powerful. I don't have any emotional attachment to it. It is not where I get my sense of worth. One of the big problems in this country is too many people who are powerless, whose lives lack meaning, whose lives lack purpose, who are angry about it, who are sad about it. Guns is where they get their sense of power. Okay, now I'm somebody. I understand that feeling. If you got a gun in your hand, you are somebody. Right? But that's the only way they know how to be somebody. If I got a gun in my hand, I'm somebody. Without this gun in my hand, I'm nobody and I'm nothing. And so there is an extreme emotional attachment to that weapon. But as Jeff always says, maybe it's time. Right. Go ahead, Jeff. If we have to pry it out of their cold, dead hand, that's your line. I'll throw it back to you.
Hello?
Have we lost Jeff?
Yeah, we may have, but he seems to still be on, but he may be just preoccupied.
I'm here.
Oh, there you
have
are.
Have you got me?
Okay. Yes, we do. We do.
I accidentally hit the mute button. I'm very sorry.
Okay.
I have been concerned ever since the Heller decision and most recently the Bruin decision, which we will talk about shortly.
Mm-hmm.
And then the things that are happening in particular in the state of Florida, where the legislature is poised to pass a law that says you can buy a gun, you don't need to take a course, You don't have to be licensed. Nothing like that. And the minute you buy it, you can stick it in your belt, cover it up with your shirt, and walk around with a concealed firearm. And that lends itself to what Brendan has just said, that you have to suspect and worry about every person who passes you on the street. We're not talking about open carry where everybody can see your gun. We're talking about anybody can go into Walmart and buy a gun. And the minute they get their hands on it, load it up and stick it in their belt in the back so that no one can see the bulge and walk around town with a concealed firearm. Now, the police don't want this new law. This is one time the Sheriff's Association has parted company with King DeSantis, King Ronald I, and his jesters that we refer to as the Florida legislature. But this is beyond the pale. And all of this was permitted under the Bruin law, the Bruin decision, which struck down New York's restrictions on carrying a concealed firearm. I am deeply concerned that the war that the far right wants, they're going to get. I am concerned that it just takes one guy who's not a far-right gun nut, who worries about a guy that is a far-right gun nut that he knows is carrying a concealed firearm and says, that guy is a threat to me, so I'm going to shoot him before he can shoot me, and walks into court and said it was self-defense because he was carrying a gun and I was afraid of him and I thought he was going to pull that gun, so I killed him first. And I don't have to wait for him to shoot at me to shoot back. All it's going to take is for someone who is white shooting someone who is not and walking out of a courtroom because I thought he was carrying a gun. I was wrong, but it was reasonable for me to believe it because he's a big black guy walking towards me with a mean look, and I was scared, so I pulled out my gun and I shot him. Because I thought he had one. They're going to get the race war that they want. That's what I'm afraid of. They're going to get the civil war that they want, and that's what I'm afraid of. I don't know what we do about it. I really don't. But the idea that everybody should be carrying a gun and people on the far right claiming, I'm being a patriot, I'm protecting my country. No, you're not protecting your country. You're protecting your white privilege, and don't ever say it's anything but that. That scares the hell out of me. 400 million guns in this country. Mm-hmm. And people say we can't do anything about it, so we shouldn't do anything about it. Well, you start small. You stop selling them. You literally outlaw guns. Yeah, I know. The Second Amendment. I'm tired of hearing the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment was not meant to authorize people to walk around with guns. I don't care what happened in the Wild West. There was no law in the Wild West. No law west of the Pecos. I know. I've read the Heller decision. It's a personal right. Yeah, okay. Maybe we need a new Supreme Court that will decide it's not a personal right. No one needs a 9mm Glock to go hunting. No one needs a 9mm semi-automatic pistol that with a piece of plastic can become a full-blown automatic weapon with an extended magazine or clip that makes the gun look like a Tommy gun, a machine gun. No one needs an AR-15. No one needs an AR-15 except for a soldier who really is defending the country. No one needs an AK-47. No one needs a bazooka. No one needs any of those weapons on a private basis. They just don't need it. It's time to outlaw them, and it's time to take them away. You need a hunting rifle? Okay, you like to hunt. Ain't much to hunt anymore. Very little deer to kill anymore. I don't know what you're hunting for. What are you, Elmo Fudd? You're hunting rabbits? But there's just no need. It's time to start and taking guns away. And it makes it hard to prosecute people who shouldn't have guns for having them. One of the favorite weapons of the federal authorities and state authorities is adding on an unlawful possession of a firearm or carrying a concealed firearm. That's one of their favorite weapons when people get arrested. And the charges against them might be weak, but we got them for that. That's how you get the bad guys, good guys. But I am really afraid that our cities and our small towns are going to turn into the wild, wild west. I don't like the way you look. Draw. No, you go first. No, no, no. If you go first, I get self-defense. You draw first. I had enough of it. You know what? Maybe we should outlaw Western movies.
Hmm.
And we should take Yellowstone off of the air. But they kill people left and right and then dump them at the train station. That's a euphemism for dumping them in Wyoming. Maybe it's time. It literally is time. Why is it every other democracy in the Western Hemisphere don't allow their people to have guns, and their children don't get shot at school, and their children don't get shot at universities, and their families aren't threatened by people who walk around with an AK-47 or an AR-15 strapped to their chest when they walk into Denny's? Because as Brendan mentioned, because they want everybody to think they got a big dick. That's what you are, not what you have. It's enough. Okay, that was my turn. Now it's your turn, Brendan.
Well, I'm going to pick up on the Second Amendment thing because these recent Supreme Court cases, and that's the thing, it's very frustrating when you talk about this, how hamstrung lawmakers are by the Supreme Court. I mean, you know, like you said, New York tried, and, you know, they lost because the Supreme Court says, no, you can't limit. You can't place reasonable limits on people's ownership of guns and where they can be and all that. In doing that, the Supreme Court is constantly citing history. And, of course, they selectively cite history, right? There's the history that they like and there's the history they don't like. They don't mention the history they don't like. They just pick, you know, little bits and pieces to get them where their ideology wants them to go. I want to talk for a minute about the real history of the Second Amendment, in case anybody is interested. The Second Amendment has that opening clause, which says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Right. That's how it opens, and then there's a comma, and then it says the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed. But there's a linkage there. The right of people to bear arms, the people to bear arms, is linked to the necessity of a well-regulated militia. Now, how you can just simply separate those two things out, just bifurcate them and say, well, they're completely unrelated, when one introduces the other, That does violence to this whole idea of textualism, which supposedly conservatives believe in, which is you're supposed to pay attention to every syllable of every word that's written, that you can't just read it out when you want to. Now, why did the people who drafted and adopted the Second Amendment, which was the first Congress and then the state legislatures, why did they want states to have militias? Well, the reason they wanted states to have militias was that they were not too fond of the idea of a standing federal army. And the reason for that was the reason the entire Bill of Rights seems to target the federal level of government and limit the federal level of government, like, you know, Congress shall pass no law, you know, all that stuff. The reason the Bill of Rights seems to target that level of government rather than states is that that generation, the generation that created the federal government, the central national government, was suspicious that it would become too powerful. They didn't want it to become too powerful. They didn't want it to completely supplant state and local governments. They didn't want the president to be a king. They didn't want the national government to dictate all policy at the local level. And they thought that one of the dangers of the federal government would be if it did have a standing army. Now, clearly the Constitution allows Congress to raise, but that's an interesting choice of words, right, to raise armies and navies. The thought was if we need one, Congress needs to be able to raise one, if there's an invasion or something. But that, generally speaking, the national defense should not be left to a national standing army, but to state militias. That's why the Second Amendment says that a well-regulated militia. So this whole idea of the Second Amendment, it had nothing to do with individual rights. It certainly had nothing to do with overthrowing the national government. The well-regulated militias were to be the primary source of national defense at a time when we didn't need a standing army. That's why we have a Second Amendment. That's the history of it. Did you see that history in any of these Supreme Court opinions? No, of course not. All the Supreme Court does is do a little survey. You say, well, okay, we have a concealed carry law in New York. Were there any laws against concealed carry in 1791 or 1868? That's the history that they want to talk about. They don't want to talk about the real underlying principles and underlying theory of why we have the Second Amendment to begin with. And so that's the real history of it. How that morphed into a right for anybody to carry any weapon they want, anywhere they want, anytime they want. Boy, did that take some intellectual gymnastics on the part of the Supreme Court. This is not intellectually honest. It is not honest about its reasoning. It's not honest about its history. But here we are. They're the ones in the robes making the rules. What should states do about it is one question. Unfortunately, the next question is what can states do about it with this Supreme Court? Real problems there. I don't know what to do about it. That's the real history of the Second Amendment.
Yeah, and the Second Amendment, as you said, was never intended to grant upon a person a personal right to own a firearm. We understand that at the time of the Second Amendment, those militia were needed, especially on our western frontier, as we expanded with our manifest necessity to do away with indigenous peoples and take their land. Those weapons were needed to defend themselves against those indigenous personnel who were fighting back. We know that those weapons were needed to feed themselves at times, to go hunting, so that we didn't interfere with them holding, because we would call upon those same people who had the guns to be the militia. And we didn't have the money to buy weapons to supply to this well-regulated militia. People had to supply their own weapons. Even in the Civil War, at the beginning of the Civil War, soldiers had to furnish their own weapons initially. So it isn't what people make it out to be. The far right says, yeah, we are a militia. We're an organization of people who believe that the country has gone in the wrong direction, and the Declaration of Independence says we have the right to throw off the tyranny. That's what the Declaration of Independence tells us. And that's their justification for saying, I have to have a gun. I don't think that's the case. Seriously. I think what's important is the preamble to the United States Constitution. We, the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution. Look at the reasons for the Constitution. We strive for a more perfect union. Nothing's ever perfect. We have established justice, but some people don't like that justice because it doesn't fit their needs. Ensure domestic tranquility. Are we a tranquil nation? Do we have domestic tranquility, or is that domestic tranquility being undermined by people who read the Constitution to fit their own personal political agendas? And I'm talking about the Supreme Court of the United States. Provide for the common defense? That sounds like about the reason for the Second Amendment. Are you going to try to tell me these right-wing fighters who go out and literally hunt people, whether it's a temple, whether it's a church, whether it's a venue for concerts, whether it's schools and children? Is that the common defense? Is that the tranquility that we're seeking? What was the purpose of the Constitution? To promote the general welfare. Are these guns promoting the general welfare? What is the purpose of the Constitution? Read it. Don't make it up. Read it. And then tell me that you're acting in accord with what the Constitution was written to do. Why is our Supreme Court doing exactly the opposite? Are you securing the blessings of liberty when you take away a woman's right to have the right to have reproductive health care? Are you securing the blessings of anybody when you walk around with a gun and say, I'm right, you're wrong, and it because you're wrong, you aren't a patriot? Is there general welfare in the ownership of a gun? Are you providing a common defense, and are you ensuring domestic tranquility? And the answer to all of those is no, you aren't, you six members of the Supreme Court, and you know who I'm talking to. Is that what you're doing? Is that how you're interpreting the Constitution and what it's supposed to mean and what it's supposed to accomplish? You have forgotten what the purpose of the Constitution is. And you don't care. When's the last time anybody on the Supreme Court cited the preamble to say this is what we're supposed to be doing? That's the Constitution today.
Where are the politicians? Where are the politicians? We don't hear anybody talking like this. Are they afraid?
The only time
of
you
the
hear the
Supreme
politicians
Court
is you hear one side of the politicians saying we have to do something, we have to do something. And we hear the
That's
other
it.
Side of the politicians saying, yeah, we have to, because it isn't guns who kill people, it's people who kill people, and we need to deal with mental illness because everybody who uses a gun to kill someone is mentally ill. That is just not true.
Mm-hmm.
Or everybody who shoots someone would plead insanity because Jim Jordan said that if I shoot someone with a gun, I have to be crazy. I want him to testify for me. Real truth was, I was pissed off, and I shot that person because I was mad, or because they support Biden, and I'm a Trump guy, and therefore he's the enemy, so that justified my shooting him. The rationale sounds crazy, but it's not crazy. It's well thought out. But Jim Jordan says I'm crazy, that everything has to do with mental health. It has nothing to do with the guns that were provided to me. Do you have any idea how easy it was for me to kill those 20 people with an AR-15 with an extended clip? That's all that was for, was to help me kill people more efficiently. Where are these? When we start talking about politicians, that's what they are. And I blame both sides for talking out of both sides of their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a hard thing to do. It's hard because you get campaign money directly from gun manufacturers. You don't even worry about the NRA anymore. They don't even use the middleman anymore. That's what this is all about. All about campaign funds. We're talking 10% of the American public is against background checks. 10%. 20% think it's wrong to outlaw assault weapons and anything that makes them automatic. 80% say get rid of them. I don't want to hear how these people are representing their districts. Lauren Boebert, who stands in a church and gives a sermon last weekend and said if Jesus Christ had a gun, he would have used it against the Romans. Well, that may have been true, not the Jesus we know. The Jesus who was an insurrectionist, who spoke against the Romans, but he never led a fight. He was like the Martin Luther King of his day. Jesus would shoot people. This is the guy that says, turn the other cheek, remember?
No.
Don't turn the other cheek.
Give unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
Yeah, give him a bullet or a spear. Lauren, you are, I used to think you're crazy. You're not crazy. You're just a moron. You are the epitome of being a moron. But how this is how these people think. When you ask the question, WWJD, what would Jesus do? Their answer is Jesus would pull out his 9mm semi-automatic and blow them all away. Really? That's what Jesus would do?
No.
Mr. Peace? It's absurd. I don't advocate people dying. But if that's how we got to get the guns, then that's the way we get the guns. Now, you know, the Supreme Court, as it's presently made up, is going to say, no, you can't do that. Because it's a personal right. And you can carry it down the street, showing it off, or you can tuck it away in your pocket so nobody knows you have it. This is Clarence Thomas, whose wife makes a fortune on right-wing, far-right-wing causes, including guns. And Sam Alito, who I believe is as anti-constitutional as any justice of the Supreme Court has ever been. This guy does not believe in the Constitution. He's going to do everything he can for as long as he can to destroy the Constitution, to create the conflict that will destroy the Constitution. I believe that. He is the judicial hand of the far right wing, more than even Aileen Cannon. You know, loose cannon from down here in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe that now. He does not believe in the Constitution. He will never convince me that he does. He believes in using the Constitution to destroy the Constitution. Enough. I know we say that all the time, enough. But let's get down to the real debate. I don't want to hear this is happening because there's crazy people. I want to know about this guy. He's 43 years old, had no attachment whatsoever to MSU, didn't know any of the students, according to a person who was there. I want you to hear this because I've got to read it because I can't give you the sound. There was an MSU student by the name of Claire Papoulias. She was inside the classroom where the suspect walked in and shot a number of students. Quote, the teacher was presenting a lesson and all of a sudden I heard gunshots directly behind me. That's when the shooter opened the back classroom door and started firing at my classmates in the back, wounding them. I smelled and saw the gunpowder. Everyone then dropped to the floor immediately and someone started yelling, shooter, everybody get down. She remembers thinking she was going to die. Quote, I thought I was going to die. We didn't know where he went. Everyone was on the ground huddling, and I just looked at my classmate and told them it was going to be okay. She said there were at least three or four shots in her classroom before he closed the door and walked away. He just was hunting students. She ran away, left everything she owned inside the room. All she was concerned about was helping her classmates. Her instinct was to run for her life. Instead, she helped her classmates who were injured, helped everyone get out the window they broke out. This is the horror that these students went through. They were locked down where they were for hours until police came and cleared their rooms one by one. Now, I congratulate the East Lansing Police, the Lansing Police, the Michigan State University Police, and all the other agencies who responded as quickly as they did and found this guy, how quickly they found him. Found out who he was, found out where he lived. They're searching his house right now. Can't wait to hear what's on his computer. Can't wait. And since he's dead, I'm not worried about it. They got a warrant. Who cares? The guy's dead. Who's going to object to you just going into his house and rummaging around? Do you know anybody that's going to do that? I teach the Fourth Amendment. They didn't need a warrant. I don't care who else was living there. They didn't need a warrant. Because the only person whose Fourth Amendment rights were being violated was this guy, and he was dead. And his rights died with him. But they did the smart thing. They went and got a warrant. They went in there, and they've been rummaging around in there all morning. Can't wait to see what's on his computer. Can't wait to see what other weapons he had there. Can't wait to see his manifesto, because I guarantee you he's got one. And we'll all say, oh, that's terrible. He has to be crazy to say those things. Really? We got millions of crazies right here in our country who are saying things like this guy's getting, we're going to find out he's sick. They're trying to find out if he's the same guy who's called in threats of death or explosions at other schools around Michigan for the past week and a half. I don't know what you do about people like this. I really don't. And then he lets himself off the hook by killing himself. We have to find a way to stop them from doing that so we can put these people on trial. And then put them into prison and take pictures of them every 6 months and put them up. This guy, this is how, what he looks like now. Maybe he'll write a diary and tell us how wonderful prison is. I don't know. Go, Brendan, go. Get me off of this. Go.
Well, while we're on the subject of people flippantly say every time, as you describe the horror of what happened there, you know, you can just see the flippant response. Well, that's the, you know, it's just the price of liberty, man. I mean, you know, that's what freedom looks like. You know, this guy had a right to have a gun, so, you know, these students just going to have to live through it.
And my answer is to that, we aren't the only country in the world with liberty. Canada mm-hmm. has liberty. Mexico has liberty. Yeah. France has liberty. Denmark has liberty. Switzerland has liberty. England has liberty. Australia, New Zealand, to name a few. Italy has liberty. Spain has liberty. It's not about liberty. And do they all own guns? And it's not a price that they're willing to pay. Their liberty is based on the fact that they don't have to pay that price. I'm sorry. I just had to get that shot in.
No, I totally agree. That's speaking of liberty, Governor of South Dakota just signed a bill making it illegal to provide gender-affirming health care to transgender minors. I want to talk about that and in conjunction with a lot of what else is going on, including here in Florida, you know, what kids are allowed to learn, what kids are allowed to talk about, what teachers are allowed to teach, what culture young ones are allowed to understand or taught about. I'm looking around, and again, what triggered this morning was this news out of South Dakota. I'm looking around at what states are doing, and I'm asking myself whether that is consistent with the promise of liberty in the Constitution. The Supreme Court in past cases, and we're going to see where the Supreme Court goes now, and whether they change their tune, because they, you know, they tend to do that when their social or cultural or ideological agendas are on the line. you talk about a couple cases from the past. There was a case decades ago out of Nebraska, where Nebraska passed a law saying the only language that teachers were allowed to teach in schools was English. And the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, said, no, 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 no. That is not the state's business. It's not the business of a state. If we are a free society, if we do enjoy liberty in any real sense, then it is not the province of the government, of the state, to dictate what language kids learn. You can't tell teachers that they can't teach other languages, and you certainly can't tell parents that they can't have their children learn other languages. That's not consistent with a free country. What you're teaching kids, does it sound familiar? What you're teaching kids is not up to the state, especially about things like culture and language. Another case, Pierce versus Society of Sisters, where the state government said, you have to send your kids to public schools, and the Supreme Court said, no, you don't. Parents have the right to direct the care, custody, and control of their children, not the state, not the government. What are they going to say now when the state says, of South Dakota, we don't care what the parents want for their kids. You don't know best what is right, what kind of care, custody, and control. You parents don't know what kind of care your child needs. The state does. Past courts would have applied something called strict scrutiny to a law like that, that burdens the fundamental right of a parent to direct the care, custody, and control of their own children. Will this court strictly scrutinize that law? Will this court say you can't do that? The state cannot tell parents how to raise their kids. I have my doubts. Will this Supreme Court tell Ron DeSantis, you, the government, don't get to decide what culture, whether children in school are taught and learn about their own culture, whether it's under the Liberty Clauses of the Constitution or the First Amendment? You don't get to make those decisions. Is this Supreme Court going to tell Ron DeSantis that? I have my doubts.
Are the people of Florida going to tell Ron DeSantis that?
Yeah, they already did.
Who sit there and tell parents, we're giving the power of education back to the parents, and ignoring the fact that the parents have always had the power of determining the education their kids get. It's called local boards of education. But his attitude is, if people who disagree with me are on the boards and they don't do what I tell them to do, we put people who ran against them who will do what I'm telling them to do in replacement on those boards, and so therefore I am giving the power back to the parents, but only the parents that voted for him. Other parents, the majority, mean nothing. That's Ron DeSantis. Everything you just described is growing fascism within this country. And the head fascist is the governor of the state of Florida. Now, just one little statistic before we go. We got a few minutes left. Do you know there have been 45 days in the year of 2023? We're on the 45th day. As of today, there have been more mass shootings than there have been days.
Mm-hmm.
There have been 65 mass shootings in the United States so far this year. More shootings than days. Is there something wrong with this statistic? If we covered every day in our news every shooting that takes place, mass or otherwise, in Chicago, New York, San Francisco, Atlanta, or any place else, these are today's shootings. The national news would take an hour and we'd never hear about anything but that. That's the way it's working right now. There's something very wrong. There's something very sick about where our society is today. And it doesn't get solved by putting a strong man in place who eventually will say, this American carnage ends right here, right now. Really? Did a great job, Donald. More mass shootings in your term than any time else in the United States, other than the Civil War. I don't want to use the word carnage because that bites into his inaugural address. But we can't live this way. We just can't. And we don't need demagogues telling us how to run our lives, like Kristi Noem or Ron DeSantis or Greg Abbott or Huckleberry Hound from Arkansas. We don't need those people. Those people who are out only to protect white privilege, not everybody, just those who are entitled to white privilege, meaning white people. We can't do this anymore. This demagoguery has to end. And those who are demagogues in Congress have to go. Or they have to start doing their jobs. I don't care which. I don't care about Hunter Biden's laptop. I don't care. And 70% of the people in this country don't care. They care about their kids and their safety. They care about buying groceries. They care about having a peaceful life. That's what they care about. Closing thoughts, Brendan.
Yeah. I don't know what they care about. I agree with you that they do care about those things. I wonder if they care about democracy. I wonder if they care about the continuing vitality of our republic. I wonder what they care about. When I watched the way that the people they voted for to control the House of Representatives, the way they behave, which was utterly predictable, I don't know what people care about. We've talked about this many times. Is the price of milk more important than our democratic institutions? I don't know. But we better start caring. I guess that's why we do this every Tuesday, to do our part in trying to get people to care. That's my closing thought.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to ask you to end, because we've got our next guest on. So just
excellent.
All the best.
Okay.
Thank you for giving all that expression. It's very, very perfect.
Thank you, Hazzy.
Maybe, who knows, maybe the Supreme Court will change their mind if they're listening.
Yeah.
Not likely. Not likely.
Oh,
I don't think it will, but convince
right.
the people first.
All right.
I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Have a great week.
Yep. All the best
Be
to
well.
You guys. Thank
yep.
you so much.
Bye-bye.
Be well.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Well, there we have it. And let's bring in our next guest, Shanae Williams. Bear with me a minute as we bring her in. Good morning, Shanae. How are you?
Hi.
Thanks
good
for
morning.
Waiting.
Good morning, everyone. Absolutely.
Well,
thank you for having me.
What a pleasure. Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you. Well, thanks for making the time. I think what's so exciting is that you're running for elected office. And what's the purpose of running, and what do you hope to accomplish as an elected official?
Right. So
go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, I thought you were finished with that question. I apologize. You can continue.
I am. No,
okay,
I'm good.
Okay, so yeah, I'm running for Westchester County Legislator of the 16th District here in Yonkers. And, you know, I'm running because I care deeply about the community and the district. I've lived in Yonkers for most of my life. I currently serve on the city council as NoHezi. I'm in my sixth year. And there's just like a lot of issues in the 16th district that I think the county could do more and focus a little bit more on, which hasn't been happening. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that I can do that. I think we owe that much to the residents. We owe them a legislator that is intentional about addressing the issues of the district. And that's why I'm running for this position, to create more accessibility, and also to just problem solve and work on the homeless crisis, work on the mental health issues that we see that's growing, not just from the pandemic, but even preceding the pandemic, this has been an issue. You know, public safety, and just making sure that we're focusing on, you know, partnering with communities and nonprofits and organizations that's doing the work to help families and children. And those are the things that I'm passionate about, and I think the county can do more there. So I hope that I get the opportunity to serve in that way.
How, you know, you're serving, and you have served for many years, as you pointed out, as a city council member. And yet there is this other level of government on the Westchester County Board of Legislators that you are vying to be elected to. And how do the two work together? Is there a different level of, of integrity of one over the other, or do they work together? And we haven't seen a relationship, though, with our present leadership there at the Westchester County Board of Legislators and the city council. Should there be one, or is it just a separation of powers?
So I think that it's similar to the way local government works in tandem with, you know, state government or federal government. All these different entities should work together. The city, you know, city council and the executive office should be able to have a fantastic working relationship with the county board of legislators and county executive, in the same way the county executive and board of legislators should have a good relationship with our state assembly and senators, so that, you know, because a lot of times, although 100% of the time, the people that we serve overlap, right? It would start to get on the same page to work to address the issues. There's certain things that only can happen on a local level, certain things that only happen on the county level and the state level, but it doesn't stop us from partnering on different initiatives to get the problem solved. And I agree with you.
I haven't really
seen of that relationship in certain areas with the county board of legislators for this district in particular, and with the city council. And I say that from experience. From the fact that I've been a council member for over 5 years now, and I haven't had one sit down with the county legislator, the incumbent, to talk about how we can work and, you know, create real initiatives that will help people get more housing, that will help people get off the streets. And, you know, those are some of the things that it falls under the jurisdiction of the county. Homelessness, the county's supposed to provide temporary housing for people and help them get out of that situation. Not the city council, but here I am, a council member, working on that anyways because I care, right? To your point, it is important to have that relationship and to have that partnership because it benefits the community as a whole.
Well, what I find impressive about your credibility is that you do have knowledge in the district on the city council, and that you could bring that to the Westchester County Board of Legislator a position, you know, if you get elected. And that's something that we've just not had. And there's a schism there, that divide should not be there. And I haven't seen a relationship like that being built before. But there are just so many issues that reside on the city council side and they reside on the Westchester County Board of Legislators side, and we're not speaking to one another. And that,
right.
I guess that's what you could bring to the equation,
right?
Which I think has been lacking for a very, very long time. How did you recognize all of this, or is that something that you gleaned because you were on the city council? And you realized that people were looking for that?
So, Hezzy, I'll be very honest with you. I think Yonkers has become so accustomed to the city pointing the finger at the county and the county pointing the finger at the city and nothing end up getting done that it becomes almost kind of like just the way Yonkers is. And I recognize that not just from being on the city council, but just being a resident here for all these years. And I want that to change. I think it's time that we elect leaders who aren't so interested in playing the politics of it all, but more interested in helping people, right? Putting the people first.
Right.
And that's where I'm from. That's the mindset that I have. And so I think, you know, if the residents of Yonkers give me the opportunity, they will see a change in the county and in the city, because whoever gets elected, whoever is working in the city, I will make it a point to work with them and not against them.
Yeah, I just find it so stellar of you to have thought this out, because it is like it should be the norm, but we haven't had that norm. You know, we've abrogated our capacity to think it out, but you have thought it out. I'm very, very impressed. I mean, and I don't say this very lightly, I'm very impressed that you are able to bring that sort of demeanor to governance. And the people are wanting it, but we've never had the personnel that could bring it forward. And it takes knowledge, and it takes heart.
Right. I've had constituents.
I'm surprised, but I'm glad.
Thank you for your kind words. But I will say that I have had constituents reach out to me and say that they haven't been able to get anywhere with their legislator. They haven't been able to get even a meeting to discuss issues within certain parks that the county owns, right? Mm. And I think that's mm-hmm. a problem. You want to be accessible to the people that help get you to the position that you're in. That's what you're there for. You're there to listen. You're there to help. You're there to, you know, work on their behalf. And if you're not giving them the time of day, then they'll remember that, and then they're going to ask for change.
Well, that's it. I think that a lot of people in elected office do not reach out to the public. They may be voted in because they belong to one party or another. But that's not the end all and be all. It's not just the election matters. It's what you do after you get elected. And we have not seen a productive discourse between our present members on the County Board of Legislators and the City of Yonkers. And I think that's a tragedy that you can overcome. And what do you see as the most pertinent way of moving this whole situation forward? How do you expect that this will become a new reality, that relationship that you would espouse and that you would promote when you're elected?
Yeah, so I think that the best way to really move forward if elected would be just right out the bat, just start getting, you know, boots on the ground and meeting with the current elected officials that's in the city, and start talking about the issues that matter. And I'll say for me, I think the biggest issue right now in the 16th district is, in fact, housing and homelessness, and all of that ties into the quality of life here, right? And so we have to address that. I know the city, myself and my colleagues on the council, we worked with the administration to implement a pilot program a couple years ago with FedPab to help, you know, do more outreach to get the homeless, the street homeless, off the street and into the drop-in shelters so they can have access to showers and food and services, caseworker, to help to get help finding jobs and, you know, medication, whatever it is that they're struggling with. These, you know, West have really had or still does have a wonderful team of people that was targeting, you know, these street homeless every day, and it takes time. It takes time to see the results, but I can say that, you know, since we've implemented the program, over 100 people have been helped, and I think that makes a huge difference. There's still so many more people that's struggling, and a lot of it is due to substance abuse and mental illnesses, but we have to be persistent in the work that we do. And so because it was a pilot program, because we only had, you know, a specific amount of funding towards this program, the city council put $2.5 million towards this, we were hoping that the county would step in and fully fund it moving forward. But, you know, and they said that they would. The county legislator was on board, but for whatever reason, the money failed to make it into the budget at the end of last year. And so that program, that pilot program, is likely to end instead of continue on. And it's a shame because these are the kind of initiatives that really makes an impact on these vulnerable populations. And if we don't have a legislator that's fighting tooth and nail to get the funding that's necessary to continue good programs like this, then we're at a disadvantage.
Well, a lot of people will tell you that when they look at the Westchester County Board of Legislators in totality, they think of it more as just people who may be elected to those positions, but they acquiesce literally to the Westchester County executive because all they do is they approve a budget that is presented to them. But they don't espouse how the allocations should be divided so that they could be a focus on how to tie in with a city and a community that should be represented. And there should be an equality of how we look at these things. Maybe it's based on populations and or however it can be defined. But it can't just be an approval and that's all they do. You
right.
know, it's
so
like,
heavy,
and then what?
That's, an approval. That's the thing that I think is important, is that the public has to better understand how government works. And in order for that to happen, you need elected officials that's going to educate the public on what they're doing and how different processes actually work. You need that transparency. And I think, to your point, because it's not just approval of a budget, you know, legislators have the opportunity to advocate and fight for what they want specific funds to go towards. And the public needs to know that. And, you know, if that's not happening, then what are we doing? You know, we're failing the people that trusted us in these positions. And I think, and that's what one of the things that I would like to see, you know, change as well and work on if elected. So I think it's important to have that transparency.
It's very, very pertinent because by not having a relationship with the people that you want to represent, by not reaching out to them, whether it be with a release in media or just an expression of thought on radio or TV, wherever you go, or even your own YouTube thing or whatever, I think that there's a disconnect there, and it pushes people away. And they think that there's no relationship, so what is there? And then they don't pay attention. They don't come out and vote. Everything breaks down.
And worse is when they only reach out and start to talk to the public when there's an election coming up. And I've heard that plenty of times in recent weeks. Been talking to constituents across the 15th district, they only see their current legislator when there's an election, and that's unfortunate. I've made it a point to be very involved and very active all year round on the city council, you know, whether I'm running or not. So I think that, you know, the people will see that in doing it, and not just, you know, take me for someone who's just talking. Like, I actually do this. I'm actually available. I have time to
right.
go into the community, be at the meetings, and meet with people. Even if I don't even show that on social media, I'm doing it behind the scenes, and I think people value that from their elected officials.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And I think, you know, you're becoming more and more known, I think, in Yonkers and probably beyond, because you are engaged, you are involved, and people recognize that. And that's the only way to have a relationship where you know what you need to do, what you can do, and also the public that you represent recognizes that you're there and you can give voice to what they have to say and what they want and what they need. So it's very, very pertinent. What made you get into politics in the first place?
I fell in love with it when I was an intern. I liked the idea of working on legislation that would leave an impact for, you know, the future. I was, you know, in college. I was at SUNY Albany.
Yeah.
I applied for the internship in the state assembly, and I was paired with Mike Spano at the time. And, you know, it really opened my eyes up to a different world. And coming back to Yonkers and having the opportunity to work in government, work in the mayor's office, and learn all about the community and politics as well. I don't love politics, but I love community work, and I love helping people and making a difference and working on legislation. So that's really where my passion comes from.
Well, the politics is just a mechanism, because
right.
that's what we have. We have political parties, and
right.
But it's what you do when you get elected that defines who you are and what you believe in, and also can redefine the district that you represent, because it's not being represented very well at the moment. I'm sure you hear that wherever you go, because no one even remembers, you know, the person who's now in there, which is amazing. This is like been lost. I don't know for how many years. I'm like
right.
in total shock. So it's crazy. It's a crazy world. So how do you promote yourself when you've got an election process like this? What do you need to do to get the message out? Or do you feel that a lot of people already know you? And I think a lot of people
do.
There's
so much to do. There's so much work to do. First and foremost, I have to be visible, whether it's online, on different
yeah.
social media platforms, or most important to me, and I think other people value this as well, is being visible in the community, on the ground, showing up, not just at community meetings and events, but, you know, at tenants association meetings, at, you know, co-op board meetings and things like that, and just being involved, you know, going and supporting
yes.
small businesses and showing up when they're hosting events. I think it makes a big difference, because people see you as the human that you are. And, you know, I've been doing that. I love doing it, so it doesn't seem like work to me, right? It comes
mm-hmm.
naturally to be around people and listen and talk about whatever is on their mind, whatever their concerns are. And so that's what I do. I also have a newsletter, and, of course, there's a website, a campaign that's at SineadWilliams.com. But I value... more people value just seeing you in person. And, you know, a lot of times what I've noticed with elected officials, traditionally they'll show up at an event, stay 10 minutes, and then leave. We know that there's always a billion
mm-hmm.
things going on. I've been very intentional about scheduling events in a way that I can spend time at each event, right, and get to know people and talk to them. And I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah, that personal, you know, pressing the palms, saying hello, you know, learning what's on people's minds, that's everything.
Right.
I don't know, have we lost that? Have we somehow aged away from all of that? Like, are we returning back to an earlier day when there was a greater personal, interpersonal relationship? And I think you bring
mm-hmm.
that forward. And I think that's what people hope for. They, you know, that's what gravitates them to you. I think that's what I see about you. There's something very ingratiating about you, and on the one hand, but also an intellectualism about you that's there, and an understanding. And those are hard facets to bring forward in politics. Some people just stick to the politics, and that's all, you know, just for them it's just an election, and that's it. And then they forget everybody for another 4 years or 2 years, whatever it is. It's
right.
Frightening.
Do you think
is the public more engaged now than ever before? It's like a resurgence of interest in politics?
I think it varies. I think it all really depends on, you know, public engagement depends on what issues are at the forefront, right?
Okay.
Oftentimes,
yeah.
For a specific thing that they're passionate about, something that, you know, they may not even understand, but they'll come out because it's controversial. But, you know, everyday business, they don't come out because, one, they don't understand how impactful quote unquote little things are, but it's not as interesting to most people because it's not controversial. But I don't think that there's more or less people engaged. I think we need to get more people engaged. I think we've seen a slight shift in a younger population getting more engaged, which I love. I've personally been, trying to put myself in positions where there's a lot of young people around so that they can see that there's a young person in office right now in me, right? And someone who cares.
Yeah.
And I can do all the things that young people do, but still be civically engaged and still be a leader in the community. And it's inspiring when they see and hear that I'm a representative, because it makes them kind of take a step back and say, well, okay, she's doing so much. How can I get involved? And it really does change.
Right.
And that's because we are future. We need more young people involved. And I'm happy to see that that's happening, but it's happening at a slower rate than I would like, but it's happening nonetheless. So it's something to celebrate.
Well, so when you get into elected office, is your interaction on a personal level through social media, through newspapers or websites, wherever, does that all help massage the message? Because
Absolutely.
People become more aware of the complexity of the message and
Absolutely.
Why the message is relevant.
Absolutely.
That's what I feel you have a great capacity to share. And by
Absolutely.
Sharing that, I think you get a good response.
Yeah, coming on shows
like educating people.
Like stores, shows like,
yeah.
you know, the British Tribune and being in the local papers, it's very much helpful. Of course, the best way is to also, not the best way, but traditionally the best way is to send mail out to let people know what your platform is for those people who aren't on social media. But realistically, almost
yeah.
everyone is on some kind of social media platform now. So you have to kind of go with the times. I'm
yeah.
on almost every platform. I, share my thoughts, my message, what I'm doing through those different platforms, social media, but going on radio stations and blogs and, TV, all of those things are a combination of factors that help to get the message out. And in order to get the message out, a lot, campaigns are very expensive. You have to raise funds to do
yes.
that, to ads and to send mailers out, and it's not easy, especially for someone who is challenging the incumbents, but it's not impossible.
No, I think a lot of it has to do with knowledge and compassion and interest and just a sense of knowing the people you represent and what they want and what they need and how to go about, bringing that about. There's a capacity that not everyone knows how to engage. But I think there's something lacking somehow on the Westchester County Board of Legislators, and we need new blood to get it to function better, because it's not been I've not noticed it to be responsive to the city of Yonkers or its residents for a very, very long time. And I don't know, it just doesn't seem to connect. That's where I see it as a problem, and it should, because they're a big financial powerhouse, and they should be able to somehow balance what's lacking in the city, and vice versa. So that's going to be a tall order, but somehow you being able to do that. I hope we'll be able to do this again, because some of the issues that you want to bring forward might be fun to explore. And
absolutely.
So that would really be cool.
I would like to talk to you more about those issues and what my thoughts are, what I would like to see happen, and how we can accomplish some things and make some changes happen.
That would be wonderful. Well, I look forward to it. I want to thank you for making the time. Thanks for hanging in there, this morning. Always a pleasure. All the best to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'll be on soon.
My pleasure. Thank you. Stay well. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, there we have it, folks. None other than a wonderful guest that's able to bring forward so many new concepts, and the relationship between the city of Yonkers, the residents of Yonkers, the Westchester County Board of Legislators, and the people that are represented by the district of Yonkers, but at the same time, it's part of compendium of the entire county, which is absolutely fascinating. Shanae Williams, she's going to bring that forward. She's got the capacity, she's got the experience. Very, very exciting, and she'll be a formidable challenger in the upcoming election. So just exceptional. And I've not known her as well, but I've been realizing more and more that she reaches out to more people. And I think that's one of the most important and pertinent aspects of people in elected office, is they know how to connect, because that's what politics is all about. Connecting in order to be able to bring about the needs, the desires, the wants, and the purposes that represent the people in the district that she would represent, which is really it's a challenge for most people, and evidently she seems to me, at least, they're very capable of going there and accomplishing all of that. Well, so that's the story where we are at the moment. Let's move on to a couple of other things and try to check up on some news as well. Bear with me a moment here. Wanted to catch up on some stuff here, and hopefully we'll be able to catch up on a couple of things. Bear with me a second. Where is it? One second. Oh, where are we here? Okay, where did I do this? Okay, this is really quite important with regard to Syria. Evidently, the United Nations has welcomed the Syrian President Bashar Assad's decision to open up aid crossings. It seems the White Helmets Rescue Group spoke out against what it said was the United Nations allowing the Syrian president to make decisions over aid deliveries. The Volunteer Rescue Group Syria Civil Defense, also known as the White Helmets, has spoken out after the United Nations welcomed the move by Syrian President Bashar Assad to open new crossing points to allow aid from Turkey to the opposition-held northwest region. The announcement came after a meeting in Damascus between Assad and United Nations Humanitarian Chief Martin Griffiths. This is a shocking, and we are at a loss at how the United Nations is behaving, head of the opposition-run rescue group Raed El-Saleh told Reuters news agency on Tuesday. On Monday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres welcomed Assad's decision to open two further crossings on the border with Turkey, allowing more aid into the region following the deadly earthquakes in the region. Well, I welcome the decision today by President Bashar al-Assad of Syria to open the new crossing points of Bab al-Salam and al-Ra'i from Turkey to northwest Syria for an initial period of 3 months to allow for the timely delivery of humanitarian aid, Guterres said in a statement. Well, the White Helmets have been heavily involved in assisting victims of Syria's lengthy civil war, with many of those in the region displaced because of the conflict between opposition groups and regime forces. The Assad regime has been accused of various atrocities during the course of the bloody conflict. So in January, top chemical weapons watchdog, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, said there were, quote, reasonable grounds, end quote, to believe that Syrian government forces had used banned chemical weapons against opposition forces in 2018 in the city of Douma. Well, the United Nations, meanwhile, has been under pressure to act over the slow pace of aid to the quake-stricken region. In 2014, the Security Council authorized four border crossings to deliver aid to northwest Syria, two from Turkey, one from Jordan, and one from Iraq. In January of 2020, regime ally Russia used its veto threat to reduce the number of crossings to two from Turkey. Well, the following year, China and Russia used their power of veto to whittle the number of crossings down to just one. The toll in the northwestern opposition-held region from the deadly earthquakes in Turkey and Syria had reached 2,166, according to the White Helmets. The Syrian Health Ministry in Damascus says that 1,414 people have died in government-held areas. Absolutely insanity. So those, you know, that's part of the reality of what's going on, and very, very frightening, to say the least. Let's see, let's move on to a couple of other issues. Bear with me a second. I've got to change figures here. This is really, really fascinating. The United States Defense Secretary says that the Ukrainian offensive is expected in the spring. It seems that the U.S. Today said that it expects Ukraine to launch an offensive against Russia over the next few months, as Russian forces continue their fight to seize the city of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine. Now, earlier on Tuesday, NATO defense ministers gathered to talks, for talks rather, on how to step up their military support for Ukraine. So the U.S. Defense Secretary Austin says he expects to see Ukrainian offensive in spring. Well, the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said on Tuesday that he expected Ukraine to conduct an offensive against Russia in the spring. Ukraine wants to create momentum. We expect to see them conduct an offensive sometime in the spring, he told reporters after meeting with NATO defense ministers in Brussels. He also said that Russia is introducing a number of new troops to the battlefield, but that many are ill-trained and ill-equipped. Asked whether Ukraine's allies on Tuesday discussed the issue of sending fighter jets to help the country in its war effort, Austin said, "I don't have any announcements to make today." Well, the Ukrainian town of Bakhmut is far from being seized by Russian forces, said Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of Russian paramilitary organization Wagner Group, today. "We won't be celebrating anytime soon," Prigozhin's communications team said via telegram. "Bakhmut will not be captured tomorrow because there is strong resistance. The meat grinder is action," he added, referring to the heavy losses incurred during 7 months of fighting in the city. Wagner, which has recruited thousands of prisoners to fight in Ukraine has been leading the Russian assault on Bakhmut since last summer. In recent days, Russian forces have captured a series of neighboring locations in an attempt to encircle the city. Ukrainian opposition is active and sends new reserves all the time, every day, between 300 and 500 fighters arrive in Bakhmut from everywhere. The artillery fire increases every day, Prigozhin added. For the moment, there is no prospect of Ukraine abandoning its position without a fight. Moldova reopened its airspace for civil aviation on Tuesday, hours after closing it for security reasons in aviation, and its aviation authority had said. Moldova's airspace was temporarily closed 11:24 a.m. on the 14th. In order to assure the safety and security of civil aviation, Moldova's Civil Aviation Authority said in a press release, and at 2:47 in the afternoon, the airspace was reopened, it added, without further details. Well, the European Union group is going to seek access to frozen Russian funds to aid Ukraine. The European Union will, tomorrow, launch an ad hoc group to investigate how Russian funds can be accessed for the benefit of reconstruction in Ukraine. That's what Sweden's Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson had said today. Quote, the mandate is to contribute to mapping which funds have been frozen in the European Union, and secondly, how to legally proceed to access those funds, Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson told a news conference in Stockholm. Sweden currently holds the European Union's rotating presidency. Moldova has also temporarily closed its airspace one day after the tiny East European country's president accused Russia of plotting to bring down its government. Russia has denied the accusation by President Maia Sandu, who has repeatedly expressed concern about Russia's intentions toward the former Soviet Republic since Moscow invaded Ukraine. A source at Chisinau International Airport advised Reuters the closure was due to security concerns. Russian news agency RIA said that the airport had confirmed that flights had been canceled, and Moldova's government did not immediately comment, however. Well, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said last week his country had uncovered a Russian intelligence plan for the destruction of Moldova. Days later, Moldova's government resigned. Norway is going to send 8 Leopard tanks to Ukraine. Team Norway will send 8 German-made Leopard 2 tank, battle tanks and other equipment to Ukraine to aid in the war with Russia, the NATO member has announced. It is more crucial than ever to support Ukraine's fight for freedom, Norwegian Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre said in a statement. Norway said it will also send 4 special purpose tanks from its armored engineering and bridge layer category, with the exact selection depending on what Ukraine needs the most, while also setting aside funds for ammunition and spare parts, the defense ministry had said. Norway, which shares a border with Russia in the Arctic, has 36 Leopard 2 tanks in total. Well, the European Union has added Russia to its tax haven blacklist, the latest in economic and diplomatic measures taken against Moscow since its invasion of Ukraine. The bloc said in a statement that Russia's 2022 tax legislation had failed to allay concerns over its opaque treatment of the tax affairs of international holding companies. In addition, dialogue with Russia on matters related to taxation came to a standstill following the Russian aggression against Ukraine, the European Council had said. Well, the Kremlin says that NATO is becoming more involved in the Ukraine conflict. The U.S.-led NATO military alliance is demonstrating its hostility towards Russia every day and is becoming more and more involved in the conflict in Ukraine, the Kremlin had said, commenting on the Western alliance's latest pledges to step up military support for Kyiv. NATO is an organization which is hostile to us and proves this hostility every day, the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters, quote, it's time to make its involvement in the conflict around Ukraine as clear as possible, end quote. Moscow claims that weapons supplies to Ukraine by NATO countries are dragging out the conflict and raising the possibility of a possible escalation. Kyiv and the West say that deliveries of advanced military hardware are crucial in helping Ukraine defend itself against Russia's offensive. Well, it's more important Finland and Sweden join soon than together, says the NATO chief. It seems that the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has said it is more important that applications from Finland and Sweden to join the alliance are ratified quickly than together. The two countries applied to NATO following Russia's invasion of Ukraine and their membership bids have been ratified by all allies except Hungary and Turkey. Ankara is widely seen as the main holdup, and Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan has indicated his country could ratify Finland's application while not going ahead with Sweden's. Well, Western officials have argued that it would be easier to integrate the two countries at the same time into NATO's military structures, but Stoltenberg suggested that was a secondary consideration. The main question is not whether Finland and Sweden are ratified together. The main question is that they are both ratified as full members as soon as possible, Stoltenberg told reporters, quote, I'm confident that both will be full members and I'm working hard to get both ratified as soon as possible. Well, Germany is going to restart production of the Gepard ammunition for Ukraine. Germany has signed contracts with Rheinmetall to restart the production of ammunition for the Gepard anti-aircraft guns it has delivered to Kyiv, German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius had said. Quote, we will quickly start our own production of Gepard ammunition at Rheinmetall. I am very happy we have been able to guarantee the delivery of this important part of air defense, Pistorius said after meeting with NATO ministers in Brussels. And Germany has been trying for months to find new ammunition for the Gepard anti-aircraft guns, which its own military had decommissioned in 2010. Well, NATO has to ensure Ukraine gets the weapons it needs, quote, to win the war, end quote, the alliance's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has reaffirmed, adding that Russian President Vladimir Putin is not preparing for peace, but is instead preparing for more war. That's a quote. And continuing, the quote is, we see no signs for President Putin preparing for peace. What we see is the opposite. He is preparing for more war, new offensives, and new attacks, said Stoltenberg ahead of a meeting of NATO defense ministers. This is a grinding war of attrition, therefore a battle of logistics, he added, referring to Ukraine's need for more weapons and talks over possibly providing aircraft for Ukraine. Well, on Monday, Stoltenberg said that NATO must ramp up production, quote-unquote, of ammunition to meet Ukraine's needs on the battlefield, which are currently draining stockpiles. Russia's Wagner Group has made further small gains around the outskirts of Bakhmut. It seems that Russia's Wagner Group has made further small gains around the northern outskirts of Bakhmut over the past 3 days, the British Defense Ministry has said in its daily intelligence update. Well, the tactical Russian advance to the south of Bakhmut has likely made little progress, Britain said in a regular Twitter bulletin. Russia likely aims to reverse some of its gains Ukrainian forces made over September and November 2022, and there is a realistic possibility that their immediate goal is to advance west of the Zaporizhzhia River, it added. Russia is rejecting claims of a plot to destabilize Moldova. It seems Russia has rejected an accusation by Moldova's president that Moscow is plotting to destabilize the former Soviet Republic. Well, Moldova's president, Maia Sandu, complained on Monday that Russia was planning to use foreign saboteurs to bring down her tiny government leadership, country's leadership, stop it joining the European Union, and use it in the war against Ukraine. Such claims are completely unfounded and unsubstantiated, Russia's foreign ministry said in a statement accusing Kyiv of trying to draw Moldova, quote, into a tough confrontation with Russia. Well, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said last week his country had uncovered a Russian intelligence plan, quote, for the destruction of Moldova, end quote. Days later, Moldova's government resigned. Well, Ukraine closed the city of Bakhmut to humanitarian volunteers on Monday, as authorities said it is now, quote, too dangerous, end quote, for any civilians to be there. Fighting near the major Ukrainian-held town in Donetsk region has been ongoing for 7 months. It looks as though the Russians are coming closer to encircling it, though they're still quite a long way from fully encircling it. That's what Gulliver Craig told France 24, reporting from Kyiv. Ukraine has closed the city to humanitarian workers, and journalists are due to increase the risk of street fighting. So we're going to have to see where all this goes. So we'll have to just see. Now, this is very, very important. This is a quote. Security concerns are driving Poland's support for Ukraine, and they say we will be in danger if Russia wins. The war in Ukraine has conferred a new importance to the Baltic states and the countries of Central and Eastern Europe geographically closest to Russia, particularly Poland. Warsaw is determined to learn from Poland's own history and help Ukraine win the war. Since Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24 of 2022, Poland has been living with the consequences. 8 million Ukrainians have crossed the border into Poland, into Polish territory since last February, and the majority of NATO assistance is delivered through Poland, which shares a 535-kilometer border with Ukraine, with a prospect of a new Russian spring offensive in Ukraine. On everyone's mind, Poland is acting as if it is preparing for a war. If Poland's support for Ukraine has been seemingly limitless, it comes from a deeply rooted belief that if Russia is not defeated, Poland itself will become a target. And security concerns have led Poland to modernize its army and boost its defense spending to up to 4% of its gross domestic product this year, the highest percentage among all NATO countries, according to Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki. If we don't support Ukraine now, there will be new targets for Vladimir Putin, said Paweł Jabłoński, the Polish deputy minister for foreign affairs. Quote, a Russian politician recently suggested that Russia should denazify, quote unquote, six more countries after Ukraine, including Poland. What we do now, we do out of solidarity and in support of the victims, end quote. Quote, the opinion throughout Polish society is that if Russia succeeds in Ukraine by claiming territory, whether in Kherson or Zaporizhia, there will be the next war and another after that, said Łukasz Jankowski, a political journalist who covers the Polish parliament. Quote, the feeling is that our basic safety and our independence will be in danger if Russia wins, end quote. There's also the threat from Belarus. Another fear is that Russian troops would combine the territories wrested away from Ukraine and create a government like the one in Minsk, said Jankowski. Following the breakup of the Soviet Union, an international treaty between Russia and Belarus was signed in 1997 by Russian President Boris Yeltsin and Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko, which created the basis for a union between the two former Soviet republics. Both countries maintained their independence, but Lukashenko has always supported Russia's military initiatives without directly taking part in them. Should the war in Ukraine drag on, some in Eastern Europe fear that Russia could eventually aim for the Baltic states. Quote, this war is not over the territory of Ukraine, but over the independence of Eastern Europe. That is why we must support Ukraine, and there should not be any limits to this help, end quote, said Jankowski. Poland's support for Ukraine has been especially forthcoming when it comes to the country's humanitarian response. Poland began to see increasing numbers of Ukrainians in 2014, the year the conflict effectively started with Russia's takeover of Crimea. Quote, we opted for a very simple way of permitting them to work, said Jablonski. Following the Russian invasion last year, a massive influx of 8 million refugees crossed the border into Poland, though many eventually went on to Romania and Moldova, while others returned home. Recent arrivals have brought the total number of Ukrainians living in Poland to 3.37 million people. In every Polish city, you can meet someone from Ukraine. There was never any ghettoization. Their integration was virtually seamless, and today, Ukrainians make up 8% of the total population in Poland, said Jablonski. Well, many Poles who take Ukrainian refugees into their homes see Ukraine as a very new nation, and they consider the relationship between Poland and Ukraine as a brotherhood, said Jankowski. The history between the two countries is not without dark episodes. During the Second World War, Poles were the victims of ethnic cleansing by Ukrainian nationalists, while Poles forcibly deported thousands of Ukrainians. Decades later, former Polish President Aleksander Kwasniewski and his Ukrainian counterpart Leonid Kuchma led a historic and formal Polish-Ukrainian reconciliation, which began in 1995. The strong bond between the two countries comes from similar languages and a shared history. In 1997, Ukraine and Poland had a no-visa regime. The experience of Ukrainians is in a large Slavic country with functioning public institutions in a free market helped drive calls for reform in Ukraine, wrote the historian Timothy Schneider in his book, The Construction of Nations. At the turn of the century, Poland resisted pressure from the European Union to end its visa-free regime with Ukraine, asserting its right to fulfill its obligations once its adhesion to the European Union became official. And once Poland joined the European Union, its special arrangement with Ukraine came to an end. While Poland has set a model in terms of welcoming refugees from Ukraine, its hospitality toward refugees from other countries has been debatable. A report from Amnesty International detailed Poland's selective solidarity, quote-unquote, of welcoming Ukrainians fleeing the war and refusing entry to other refugees, principally from Syria, Iraq, or Afghanistan, who were attempting to enter Poland through the border with Belarus. Is there an element of self-interest in Poland's extensive help to Ukraine? Polish Vice Minister for Foreign Affairs Jablonski wrote off the idea, claiming instead that the number one priority was to defend Ukraine and Central European states from a resurgent 2021. Russia demanded NATO to withdraw from Central Europe. If our international position grows while we are helping Ukraine win the war, we would be glad, he explained. Quote, if Germany had taken a stronger position for Ukraine, we wouldn't have to take on this role. I wish we didn't have to take on this role, said Jablonski, while citing the power imbalance between Central Europe and Western Europe, whose citizens often have the top leadership positions in European institutions. So we want to strengthen NATO and be a driving force within it. An opportunity for developing Central Europe's role would be through a future Polish-Ukrainian treaty, which could be signed in the upcoming weeks or months. Comparing it to the Elysee Treaty between France and Germany, Jablonski said it would be a wide security, cultural and economic agreement, and the treaty would certainly not be an alternative to NATO. We want to strengthen NATO and be a driving force within it, said the deputy foreign minister. When it comes to integrating Ukraine into the European Union, Polish leaders and observers are under no illusion. Quote, we know corruption exists within the Ukrainian administration, but Poland, which joined the European Union in 2004, can help with its know-how, said Jankowski. With the enlargement of the European Union, citizens from Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine found themselves materially and symbolically separated from Europe, according to Snyder, who noted that the hard border may have been helpful to authoritarian rulers like Lukashenko. By helping Ukraine, Poland is considering, quote, lessons that were repeated in the past, end quote, said Jablonski, because otherwise we could be victims again. And that is the final word for our day today. So I want to thank you for being with us. Thanks to all our listeners. Thanks, of course, to Shanae Williams. Thank you, of course, to law professor Jeffrey Schwartz and fellow law professor Brendan Beery. I was brought to tears listening to Jeffrey Schwartz talk about the killings at WMU Cooley Law School in Michigan. It's absolutely frightening. Just the thought of it, that people are willing to kill. It's absolutely insane. I don't know what's happening. Everywhere you go, people have lost, and maybe it's just like Jeff had said, they don't feel secure in who they are. They feel powerless, and a gun makes them feel powerful. It is absolutely amazing. Something is wrong, and I think the only solution was one that Jeff made. We've got to get rid of all guns. Nobody should have a right to have a gun at all, for any reason. The only people that should have guns would have to be the police. And, you know, and it goes from there. Or maybe if the police didn't even have guns, would make a difference as well. But we'd have to get rid of the population having it. Anyway, it's time for us to go. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Wednesday. All the best, and thanks for being with us today. Goodbye.